I'm really honoured tonight to be coming off the bench, if you like, to give this presentation. I've been involved in the climate sustainability and society subject for 3 years now, and it's a real honour for me to be able to step up and give a plenary lecture for this subject. Tonight I'm going to bring an international flavour, an international perspective to our discussion of climate change adaptation. And hopefully that can feed into the broader community discussion that we're having here. And it's nice to see some familiar faces from outside of the La Trobe network here tonight as well. The great thing about overseas travel and studying other countries is that it gives you a fresh perspective, perspective on our own society. Gives you a fresh look on things that are familiar without the baggage of your ordinary life. So hopefully that's what I can provide you tonight. In looking at the North Korean case study, you can get some lessons that might be applicable to Australia. Even though I'm not going to raise that explicitly, that's a theme that I'd like you to keep in mind as I progress. All right. As Catherine mentioned, I've recently been on a study tour of North Korea in July of this year. So on the slide there, you can see the circles in red. They're the places within North Korea that I went. So I spent a lot of time in the capital, Pyongyang, which is in the east there, but also went down to Sariwon and Kaesong, Kaesong being near the border with South Korea and also the location of a joint facility industrial project between North and South Korea. Also went over to the west coast to Wonsan and Hamhung. This area has only recently been opened up to foreigners in the last year, so it was a big privilege for me and my travelling companions to be able to go there. In the past, I've also spent a lot of time in other areas in and around North Korea. So late last year, I went to Yanji and Fengshuan, which you'll see right at the top of the graphic in the north, which is in the Korean Autonomous Prefecture of Jilin Province in China. And it was very cold at the time, let me tell you. I've also spent a lot of time in South Korea and in Seoul, and that was the gave me my initial interest in North Korea, living and studying in South Korea. And also spent time in Dandong, which you'll see on the China-North Korea border in the east, where I was an English teacher for a while. And I had a few students of mine who lived and worked across the river in North Korea, which was a fantastic insight into a country which is, for most parts, inaccessible to foreigners. You may have seen in the news in recent weeks that there's been flooding in North Korea. A couple of typhoons have made their presence felt in East Asia, one of which has hit North Korea head-on. This gives you a really excellent case study into climate change adaptation. Flooding is a regular feature. Large-scale, disruptive, chaotic flooding events occur almost annually in North Korea. We've seen them 1995, 1996, 2001, 2002, 2004, 2005, 06, 07, and now in 2012. This is a regular feature of life for North Koreans. And with the advent of climate change, this is likely to become an even greater occurrence, more frequent, more intense. What this does, it highlights North Korea's climate change sensitivity. It highlights that the type, magnitude, and frequency of extreme events in North Korea are likely to increase. And this is really pertinent for North Korea. So what we're seeing, climate change is one of the impacts. It's turbocharging the hydrological cycle, which means precipitation regimes change. Types of rainfall events alter. So we see more frequent and intense storms and typhoons, examples of which you're seeing on the video graphic on the slide at the moment. You're seeing changes to the types of rain events that happen during the East Asian monsoon. North Korea receives most of its rain during the summertime, traditionally during a 4 to 6 week period over July, June and July. Instead of that, what we're seeing now are more sporadic rain events, but they're occurring big dumping rain events that are leading to flooding, a much different type of rain regime than the traditional pattern. We also intersperse that with the occasional drought, and we had one of those in 1997, I think, another one in 2000, and North Korea's claimed that they're in drought this year as well, although there are questions about that claim. It might be, having been there this year, I saw the country was definitely not in drought, and the government may be perpetrating that ruse in order to obtain aid from the international community. The flooding in North Korea also highlights North Korea's vulnerability to climate change impacts. And when we think of this, we're talking about the capacity of human systems, like governance, like economies, like people's living arrangements, the capacities of these systems to adapt to climate change impacts. And what the flooding highlights is that in North Korea, in this case, there's deficiencies in certain areas of their ability to adapt. So if you look at the availability and equitable access to economic resources, this is an issue in North Korea. The availability of appropriate technology, this is an issue. The availability of information pertinent to adaptation and the people with the skills to put that information into practice. There's a question about infrastructure, as well as questions about the institutions of the North Korean state and the types of governance structures that they have. These all come into question when you bring climate change into the equation. So let's look at those five or six facets of adaptation in more detail. And the first one I'd like to consider is economic resources. So in the picture here, you see a bunch of new buildings which were constructed in the last year or so in central Pyongyang in an area called Mansudae. Now, these were built in line with an ideological campaign called Make North Korea a Strong and Prosperous Country by 2012. And the reason that campaign is in place is because this year is the centenary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, who is the founder of the North Korean regime. So this is a very important year in North Korea. And for me, it was a great year to go and actually see what's going on there. So these buildings that you see, very modern, very chic. The regime cites this as evidence that they're developing the country and making it strong and prosperous. What I submit to you, though, however, is that this is not representative of what's going on across the country. Have a look in this photo. Have a look down the bottom. You'll see that there's no cars in the photo. Now, why is that? One, there's an energy shortage across the country. And this is a result, this stems back to 1991 and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, this is pertinent to the North Korean case because North Korea is a small country, has hardly any natural resources of its own except for a few in terms of coal, uranium, that kind of thing. It has no energy resources of its own. So it was dependent almost entirely on imports from the communist bloc. Very much dependent on manufactured goods and food imports from the communist bloc. So 1991, the Soviet Union collapses, all of these import streams come to a stop. Now, what's the result of that? In terms of the economy, we get a process of deindustrialization, sort of the reverse of economic development. So let's explore that further. What do I mean by deindustrialization? Well, here's a clue. Look at this picture. This is a picture I took in a fertilizer factory in Hamhung. This was built by East German technicians in the 1950s, just after the Korean War. And what it looks like it hasn't been touched ever since. Now, production in this facility and others like it is intermittent. One is because of energy shortages. So if you're the factory manager, you don't know when you're going to get your energy supplies. It makes it really hard to ramp up production in a big way. And likewise for other inputs. So the raw materials that are used in the production process. For various reasons, including constraints on supply, bottlenecks in the economy due to the way it's set up in a command system. This makes it really hard to keep production at a steady rate, so it seesaws. The other thing you notice from the picture is that the technology is very old that's in there. It's obsolete. The factories and the people that made them no longer exist. So it's very hard to maintain machines like this when there's no spare parts available. So that's another constraint on production in this facility. Now, bear in mind, this is one that they're showing off to foreigners. So this is one of the best ones in the country, which makes you wonder what other facilities are like. So what are the consequences of having an economy that's in this kind of state? One is that North Korea doesn't make anything of any value. So they can't export goods to the international community to generate foreign income because no one wants what they produce, or they can't produce anything that can generate money. So if you've got no foreign currency reserves, it makes it really difficult for the North Korean state to import things that they need. So back in the Soviet times, the Soviet Union would give them the inputs that they needed for their economy on a concessional basis. So they'd give it to them for mates rates on the cheap, or they'd give it to them as aid. Nowadays, they don't have any friends that will extend them that kind of largesse. So they have to buy things on the international market. If you don't have the money to buy those things, then you don't get them. This is a symptom of a broader isolation from the international economy that North Korea suffers. And partially it's to do with self-imposed ideological restrictions. So North Korea has an ideology called Juche, which broadly speaking means that they're trying to pursue self-reliance and pursue policies that will benefit the Korean state without the assistance of outside powers. Also, as you may have noticed, North Korea's built up a nuclear weapons program. And one of the results of that is that the international community has imposed economic sanctions on North Korea. So that constricts their ability to interact with the global economy and bring in income. So in terms of climate change adaptation, if you add all these things together in the economic picture, it means there's a very small cap on the amount of financial resources that are available to the North Korean government to spend on climate change adaptation. And what financial resources they do have are funneled in a priority way to the military for things like the nuclear weapons program. Here's another picture from the city of Hamhung. This is a residential area. And what this illustrates is that the standard of living in places that are outside the capital city of Pyongyang is much different to that that's enjoyed by people in the capital. And this gives you a clue about the equitable distribution of wealth in North Korea, or lack thereof. Living in Pyongyang, in the capital, is like living in a utopia. It gives a positive incentive for North Koreans to toe the line, to advance their careers, to follow the state ideology, to support the government, because they're rewarded by living in the capital. And that's part of the, instead of having to coerce people with the threat of punishment, this is a positive incentive to be part of the system and to support the system. But as a consequence, it means that those people living outside of the capital have a much lower standard of living. So this is a problem for climate change adaptation. People outside the capital city have a far lower resource base in order to base their adaptation decisions. So that's a very important point. Let's think now about agriculture for a minute. So what impact did this economic collapse in the mid-1990s have on agriculture? What we see is a depression of agricultural production. So less food is being produced for the country. We had a system there of agriculture prior to 1991 that was heavily mechanised, which means they used a lot of tractors, a lot of chemicals and fertilisers. It was a very industrialised process of agricultural production that was common across communist countries and shares a lot of parallels with what we do in Western countries today. What happens to that when you have a rapid halt to energy supplies? Mechanised agriculture grinds to a halt. So what you see on the slide here is the tractor of choice in North Korea. oxen. It also means that farming in North Korea is very labour intensive. So in Australia, if you drive around on country roads around farms, you'll be lucky if you see anyone. In North Korea, the country areas are crowded with people. And that's because you need lots of people to do the manual labour of the farming system. Possibly that's what Western societies looked like prior to industrialisation, when manual labour was how farming was done. An interesting aside to that, occasionally you'll see some trucks that look like they're on fire, so little lorries, and on the back they have a drum billowing with smoke. Now these are a curious adaptation option, where they've constructed these trucks to run on small coal briquettes rather than petrol. And these are the type of innovations that you come up with when you face energy shortages. It's ingenious, it's not ideal, it looks kind of funny, but given their technological constraints, it makes sense. I love it when phones ring in times like this. So the upshot of all this is that it means when it comes time to harvest agricultural crops, it takes a long time to do it, which leads to crop losses. Now this is the problem. In North Korea, the growing season is very short. The Korean Peninsula is on a reasonably high latitude, which means summer's a lot shorter than it is here. So you've only got a set amount of time to harvest your crops before it gets too cold and they die off. Another problem with that is that North Korea is also a very mountainous country. So for those of you that were in my tutorial the other day, we talked about arable land, or land that's used for farming. Well, North Korea only has 18% of its entire land mass is arable land, which is a very small proportion considering its population. So when you've got real physical limits on the amount of farmland that you have, experiencing any kind of crop losses through inefficiencies is really unacceptable, and this leads to food security problems. What you see now are other examples of coping mechanisms. So when people have food security problems, this slide illustrates that gardening when it counts. These are private plots. In North Korea, almost all of the farmland are called collective farms. When the government owns them, they're really big facilities, and the people that actually farm them, they're not farmers as we know them, they're more like factory workers, they're employees. And the produce that they generate gets given to the government and then redistributed that way. So there's no incentive for the farmers that work it to actually work hard because they're not getting the fruits of that labour. What the government's done is said, okay, you can grow sort of private garden plots around your houses and you can keep that. You can sell it, you can eat it, you can do whatever you like with it. So what you see on this picture are the best looking crops in all of North Korea because the people that grow them get to keep them, so they have an incentive to make them grow well. Particularly the one on the bottom right-hand corner. This is a private plot, a collective farm. If you look at a house in Australia, a suburban house, you might have a veggie patch, you know, a few metres wide. In North Korea, these private plots cover every single bit of dirt around a house because this could be the difference, this type of garden, between living and dying in a famine year. So that's a possible lesson we can work from in Australia. Backyard gardening is an adaptation measure. Can be the difference between life and death. Now, I love this picture. This is a 1950s Cholima tractor, North Korea's one of its most famous industrial icons. It's emblematic of North Korea's technological gap. If one of these big collective farms is really lucky, they might have one of these. Most of them don't. Again, 1950s technology, very hard to maintain without access to spare parts. Based on Soviet designs, so that the factories that used to make them no longer exist. So, not surprising. If you've got one of these, the rest of the labour is going to be done with ox-drawn carts or by hand. Now, an example in terms of climate change adaptation of this technology gap. So as I've said, the country experiences flooding every year, which means they have to build dikes and walls, the flood protection, so that farmland doesn't get inundated. Now, in an industrialised country, you would use heavy machinery to put these things together to make them strong. In North Korea, because that's all done by hand, those defences are very weak, so when you get a big rain event, often they're washed away. So, you know, this is the kind of impact that happens when you have poor technology. The adaptation choices that you make are limited, and what you come up with is often of inferior quality, and which means you have to devote even more energy to fixing them up. So you're taking labour away from more productive things like growing food. All these feedback loops occur. Successful climate change adaptation also requires the best information available and people with the skills to put that information into action. Planning for adaptation requires information about local vulnerability and options for increasing local level community resilience. Adaptation is enhanced by good education and the provision of easy to access information by the people who are going to be affected by climate change impacts. Now, North Korea is not well placed to satisfy each of those three needs. Now, for one, there's a very big conformist pressure on people within the regime, within the hierarchy of the state. So there's the usual competitive aspect of career advancement. So remember, in North Korea, the state bureaucracy is huge. It employs a quarter of the people in the population. So people are competing for jobs. And in that environment, it means there's a very big pressure to toe the line and do whatever the official policies are. But what if the official policies are flawed? This is a big issue. Also, other pressures on people within this bureaucracy. North Koreans have to go through something called struggle sessions or self-criticism, where in their small work teams, everyone attacks each other on a weekly basis and tell your colleagues what they've done wrong and then they attack you. And it's like a chicken pecking party where everyone's attacking everyone. And the goal of that is so that people at the similar level don't trust each other. And the only entity they can trust is the government, the leaders. Now, for those people who don't toe the line, they can get sent to prison or re-education camps where the mortality rate is very high. Or if you do something really bad, you can be executed. From time to time, people with technical knowledge are also purged from the government service. Now, that could mean getting sent to a camp. And by camp, I mean prison. And this happens particularly when there's some kind of crisis event. Someone needs to be blamed. So a mid-level official will be singled out and they'll be sent off to the camps or executed so that the higher-ups don't have to take responsibility for what went wrong. Again, this is not great if you're talking about successful adaptation. Oh, let's go here. If you're in this system, you need to frame whatever policies you carried out to make it consistent with whatever the dominant government ideology is at the time. And this is articulated by the people right at the top of the power structure in the country. So this sign is a sign talking about what I discussed before, the Strong and Prosperous Country by 2012 campaign. So if you're a mid-level official trying to execute an adaptation policy, you've got to make sure that what you do is entirely consistent with those ideas coming from above. And there's very little freedom of action for someone in that position. So this is a problem if those directives from above are not world's best practice in adaptation. It's not great if those things are counterproductive and actually make matters worse. That can also happen because the education system in North Korea is very heavy on indoctrination, indoctrinating people to support the state, to support the government unconditionally, as opposed to giving them more technical information and skills.
that could actually be useful in the workforce.
So imagine if you went to school here, and especially for you younger students who've just emerged from the school system, imagine if you spent a large slab of your time in the classroom learning how to love Julia Gillard, or learning how to love Tony Abbott, or whoever the leader happens to be. How would that prepare you to be a functional member of a modern economy? Obvious answer, it wouldn't. So education is not a productive enterprise, and that has tangible consequences for the ability of the country as a whole to adapt to crisis situations, because people lack the knowledge and skill base to put adaptation policies into practice. Now, the country's land management policies are a very, very good example of this. Now, I don't know if you can see on the slide, but what you'll see all the way up the mountain here is, one, there's no trees, and two, the mountainsides have been cultivated almost to the top. And these are not the terraces that are reinforced like you might see in Vietnam or in Southeast Asia somewhere. These are just people with a hoe or a shovel that have just dug rows on slopes that are like this. The trees are gone, one, because they've been removed so cultivation can take place, but also energy shortages. Energy is a big issue here. People need to heat their homes, go chop down trees for fuel. So a lot of mountainsides in North Korea are completely denuded. There's no trees on them for these two reasons. It also comes back to ideology again. In North Korea, there's a real strain, an idea that man exists to reshape nature, to create something that in official literature is called creating a socialist fairyland. We're treating the natural environment as something to be engineered rather than treating it as a living dynamic system. And I can show you, this goes back all the way to the beginning. This book by Kim Il-sung, the regime founder, articulates these very themes. This one by Kim Jong-il, the dear leader who died last year, articulates the same themes. The new leader, Kim Jong-un, one of his first public speeches, was articulating land management policies that reflected the traditions of the previous leaders. So this traps them in a box where they're committed to the ideological proclamations of previous leaders, even though often they don't work. And this is what happens when you pursue flawed policies. So you have a heavy downpour. The hills, because they've been stripped, they don't absorb much water, so it all washes down into the valleys. It makes flooding worse in the valleys because none of the water stays on the hill. None of it's trapped by plants. You get increased soil erosion, and you can see this very clearly in the picture that there's been subsidence, and that will be a direct result of rainfall. So those floods destroy the farmland in the valleys below. And again, North Korea doesn't have much farmland. So every time there's a flood that destroys some, this has real implications for food security. And then all the dirt and silt that's washed off the mountains, that ends up in the riverbeds. Now, North Korea gets a lot of power from hydroelectricity. So when all this silt washes into riverbeds, it clogs up the turbines in hydroelectric dams, and you get an even greater energy crisis, which then leads people to go cut down more trees, etc., etc. All these feedback loops from poor adaptation. North Korea does get assistance from the international community, from international organisations like the United Nations, like the World Food Programme or the Food and Agriculture Organisation. And these organisations assist with training local people and implementing more appropriate adaptive practices. But there's restrictions on this. North Korea tries to keep itself in an information box so that the people don't learn what's happening in the outside world, because the theory is if they learn how people in South Korea live, how people in Australia or America live, North Koreans would compare that with their own lives and think they're getting a raw deal, and that might lead to social unrest. So the result is whenever foreigners go into North Korea, there's very heavy restrictions placed on them. There's restrictions on where you can go. There's restrictions on people you talk to. It's illegal for an ordinary North Korean to speak to a foreigner. So only designated people can talk to you. And this comes from also from an ingrained distrust of other countries. Historically, both Koreas have been the playthings of great powers and have suffered a lot, particularly over the last 200 years. North Korea in particular has a great distrust of the United States, with some justification. And I'm not going to give you a lesson in the Korean War. That's something you can read up on, but that's where it stems from. This anti-Americanism is a key factor in North Korea's ideology. The government uses the external threat of the United States to legitimise its own power and legitimise the social controls it keeps over the population. So it's protecting North Korean people from imperialist aggression of the Americans. And you can see that's the theme that's depicted on this propaganda mural in the slide. Now, of course, all these cumbersome restrictions mean that's a restriction on constructive information flowing to the people that could use it to construct positive climate change adaptation on the ground. So every time you put a barrier to information, it makes it that much harder for climate adaptation to actually work. Infrastructure is another issue. Good infrastructure is integral to having a good, sound adaptive capacity, and this is particularly in relation to disaster responses. So in the picture you see a railway line, fairly innocuous. Most of these were built in the 1930s by the Japanese when they'd colonised Korea. Most of the trains, like the other technologies we've seen in this slideshow, 1950s Soviet built, in really bad condition. The tracks are in really bad condition. And when you don't have heavy machinery to fix the tracks, it has to be all done by hand. Very slow process. So the train system is very cumbersome, lots of delays. It's not a reliable way to move people around, move goods around. Likewise, the roads are in pretty bad condition. The main north, south and east-west road arteries across the country are paved concrete. They're in pretty good condition because they've been designed to accommodate tanks and artillery in the event of war. But they're still pretty bumpy, and I'm still sporting a lump on my head from hitting my head on the roof of the bus when we were rolling on that trip. The other roads are mostly unpaved dirt. So what's the consequence? If you combine this with energy shortages, in the event of a disaster, it's really hard to get people to a place to help out with disaster recovery. It's really hard to move food or aid or other materials that are desperately needed to move them around. And often, remote locations will be completely cut off. And this happened during the mid-1990s when North Korea was in famine. All of these factors came into play to make sure that those outlying regions were completely on their own. And the last point I'll touch on today is about governance. So strong and well-organised government institutions are a key pillar of successful climate change adaptation. The North Korean government, as a totalitarian dictatorship, obviously tries to maintain very strong institutions in a very Orwellian style. But let's bring together all the things that we've just learnt. Institutional command and control structures limit the freedom of action of government institutions during a time of crisis. So all these restrictions on what people through the hierarchy can and can't do means that a government response is very rigid. And in a time of crisis, government response needs to be flexible and adaptable to the situation. The weak economy limits the amount of resources that are available to the government during a time of crisis. So that limits what they can do. If you can't afford an adaptation measure, if you can't afford to help, then you can't do it. Technology and infrastructure restrictions. place real limitations on the capacity of institutional action
for reasons I've just described.
And ideological commitments trap government institutions and trap the people that work within them into a box that restricts the kind of adaptive measures that they can undertake because it has to be consistent with what the ideology is. Now, factor in climate change into all these problems, and you have what we call the threat multiplier effect. All of these pre-existing weaknesses are made worse, are exacerbated with the addition of climate change impacts. So what are the consequences? For one, the official ideology becomes discredited because the government can't do what it says that it can do. As this happens, the leadership loses legitimacy. It can lose the support of the people because it's not fulfilling its end of the government bargain. Even in a dictatorship, this is important. If the situation goes really downhill, sometimes government institutions can fail. Sometimes you can have a failed state. And in the mid-1990s, North Korea was on the verge of becoming a failed state because lots of its institutional structures didn't work for all the reasons I've outlined. If this happens, people develop their own coping strategies to deal with circumstances. Now, that's a good thing. But if you're trying to maintain a dictatorship where everyone is supposed to be dependent on the government, people acting outside of that framework is a threat to the legitimacy of that government. Also, if everything starts to break down, people leave. People migrate. They leave the country. And this is what we saw in the 1990s and we continue to see today. People leaving North Korea as refugees across the Tumen River in the north, predominantly into China, where they'll try and set up there and then escape to somewhere else, to a third country, often South Korea or the United States. And tens of thousands of people took that opportunity in the mid-1990s. That's a problem if a lot of your educated people with technical skills decide to get up and leave, which again reduces the ability of the country as a whole to adapt because you're losing that information and you're losing that skill base. So I'll draw a line under that there. Thanks for your attention. I'm very happy now to field some questions.
I just had one. What is the population of North Korea?
It's about 21 million or 27, 20-something million.
Is that the official population or is it the real population?
Yeah, it's the real population.
And what's that compared to South Korea?
South Korea is much larger, than in a realm of about 40 million.
It's hard to tell from the photographs you've taken because there were no people in them, really.
Yeah, that's a great point that you raise, and there's a very good reason for that. And one of them I alluded to is that it's illegal for normal people to speak to foreigners. So if I went up to Joe Blow in the street and tried to talk to them, they'd get in trouble. They would have to report that in their weekly struggle session. And depending on what was said, that could mean, you know, real consequences for them. So often they'll just, if they see foreigners about, they'll avoid them, get out of the way, or someone associated with the tour will come in advance and clear people out. So there's not that many people around you. So the pictures are misleading because it looks like there's no one there, but there's plenty of people around. Also, in the countryside, we were warned, or anywhere we were warned, do not take photos of any military people. This is a big no-no. So in the countryside, the people in the army go and do farm labour or they go and do construction work. So if you take pictures of big lumps of people, it's highly likely that there'll be military, there'll be army people in that lump. And you'll get in trouble for it. And what you get to see on your tour will be restricted because you've broken one of the rules. So for all those reasons, there's not many people around in the photos.
Earlier in the lecture, you talked about the North Korean regime using the excuse of the drought to potentially extract international aid. I'm just wondering, how does the regime, or do the people of North Korea recognise the recognise that aid is going to fuel the regime, and how does the regime justify gaining that aid to the people?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. So you'll see sacks of rice donated by the United States will say donated by the United States on them for, to try and get propaganda value out of it. But I guess if you're an everyday North Korean struggling to survive, you don't care where the food comes from. You know, you'll get it wherever it comes from. Often that food is taken by the government and then they on-sell it in a black market. So it's not clear where it's come from because the government's selling it or privateers are selling it. Some food comes in from China and is sold in private markets that way. So if you're lucky enough to be in one of those border regions, you can get food that way.
I'm just wondering, with the weaknesses you described in the Korean government, can they be also applied to other areas like businesses or local communities?
Whereabouts? In North Korea or elsewhere?
Anywhere, but not North Korea specifically.
Yeah, well, the North Korean case is special because there are no, well, technically, are no private businesses because everything in the communist economy is owned by the state, is owned by the government. Now, one of the consequences of institutions not functioning properly as a result of the famine is that you start to get black markets bubble up from below. So people are selling stuff on the sly, which if they were caught would get them in a great deal of trouble. But that's a coping mechanism. If the state can't provide the ration that it's meant to provide, people have to eat somehow. So people start buying and selling food. For example, if you've got one of those private plots where you grow some of your own food, then you can sell some of that and make some money. If you work on a farm, on one of the big collective farms, you can steal some of the produce and then sell that on the sly. So you get this grassroots capitalism bubbling up from below, and that discredits the government. In Australia, because we are a capitalist economy, things work differently here.
Thanks, Ben. It's a very interesting talk. Two questions. What's happening to the... you've told us what the population is. Is the population growing? And this is my second question is, how does this compare to what China was like in the 1940s? Is it, you know, it had great problems with poverty and so on, and how does that compare?
Yeah, well... The estimates of the number of people that died during the famine in the 1990s was anywhere between about 100,000 to 2 million. 600,000 to 800,000 is probably the best estimate. So that's a lot of people in a country of 20, 21, 25 million people. Yes, it's similar to what happened in China and what happened in the Soviet Union because a lot of the problems of how the economy was organised across the communist bloc are the same. A lot of the inefficiencies in those systems are the same. But what makes North Korea unique is its complete dependency for key inputs into the economy on those other countries. So energy, additional food supplies, fertilizer, manufactured goods. Those other countries still had those things and still made those things, whereas North Korea didn't. So there's a very clear point at which the economy and agriculture goes downhill because those inputs stop.
I'm just interested, you didn't show many photographs of sort of factories and industrialisation, but I'm just interested in the pollution side of life. Is there a lot of pollution there? And what's the pollution regulation mechanism? Obviously there's no EPA, but what is there?
Yes, there is an environmental protection law in North Korea, which I'm investigating at the moment, so I can't tell you the exact ins and outs of it. If you go to Pyongyang, the pollution levels are much higher because there's a concentration of people. There's more cars than there are anywhere else. And also, people for home heating use these coal briquettes, which is a very dirty form of fuel burning. So in kitchens, they'll burn them to cook things. They'll burn them to heat their houses. and that creates a haze. But it's nowhere near on the level of cities like Beijing or Shanghai or other places that have massive air pollution. Having said that, though, looking at United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change documents that North Korea tabled for its membership in that, just before the Soviet collapse, the numbers indicate that North Korea was one of the worst carbon polluters in Asia. But of course, once you go through this deindustrialisation process, then that pollution goes down a big way. And if you're outside Pyongyang and any of the other cities, the pollution's negligible. It's not noticeable.
Is that on? Ben, I was just wondering, am I naive in thinking that the North Koreans are completely guileless and that there's no opposition to the government that might bring on something like an Arab Spring there?
Yes, that's my current research project, is investigating that. No, North Koreans are not guileless. And look, the government's not naive either. The government is concerned about climate change issues, but there's very real limitations on what they can do, which I've described here. As for like an Arab Spring type scenario, there's a couple of differences. Arab countries are characterised by lots of social, ethnic, religious divisions. In North Korea, none of them exist. It's completely ethnically homogeneous. Religion has been very much downplayed by the regime, so that's not a factor. The real religion in North Korea is worship of the leaders. The leadership cult there is, it's something else. A week there, I was exposed to it, and it was, you get nauseated by it. It's pervasive. So it's like, the personality cult is like a religion there. And ideological divisions, well, the real ideological division in Korea is at the DMZ, at the 38th parallel between North and South Korea. So all of those divisions that helped bring on the crisis in Arab countries don't exist in North Korea. The one thing that might start to tip the balance is if these capitalism from below, all of these coping mechanisms that people develop off their own bat to deal with the fact that government institutions don't work properly, this has the potential to start changing the society from underneath. But that'll be an ongoing process, and it might be a crisis event later on that turns that into something more of a revolution.
Hi, thanks, Ben. I'm really interested in just a really, I suppose, quite a practical problem is when you're travelling in North Korea, what currency do you use? Are they looking for getting currency, odd foreigners like you who turn up? Is this a way that currency comes in? And if you can't use their currency, how do you buy things?
Oh, that's a great question. The North Korean won is worthless. So, there's a real advantage to using foreign currencies. North Koreans want to get foreign currency because it has purchasing power. So the Chinese yuan, American dollar or the euro are all used in North Korea. The local currency.
And so every shop you could just turn up with any of those currencies and use them anywhere?
Well, that's the thing. There's not really shops in North Korea, because ordinary people get their goods through rations, so it's just distributed to them. And there's sort of small places where they can buy and sell things, perhaps in a marketplace, official marketplace. There's started to be small roadside kiosks where someone will sell drinks or cigarettes and stuff like that. But apart from that, there's not really shops. The places they take foreigners are places where they sell things like this, propaganda material, souvenirs, all the stuff that I spent hundreds of euros on as a tourist. And that's a revenue raiser for the North Korean government. But yeah, if you're in North Korea, you're at a tremendous advantage if you can get access to foreign currency.
Are there any more questions?
Can they not get... is there no news access? Somebody has a TV, radio, mobile phone where people must look in and see this wondrous world just over the border that incites excitement or dismay with their government and the spread of rumours. And how can it be so insular?
Oh, you'll like this story. I go into a hotel room, turn on the TV. The first channel I look at is playing a North Korean opera that's describing a famous battle from the Korean War. Change the channel, same thing. Change the channel, same thing. Change the channel. Went through 20 channels and it's the same channel. There's only one channel. So, yeah, and all of the TVs and radios and so forth are calibrated so that they only pick up the one channel. Well, there's a couple of official radio channels as well. And because the government distributes these devices, they manufacture them that way. There is a new and growing mobile phone network in Pyongyang, where an Egyptian company, Oriscom, went in and set up a 3G network in Pyongyang. There's about 500,000 subscribers to that now, but still, if to get access to that, you need to be someone of reasonable importance in the state bureaucracy. And they're also calibrated so that they can't make international calls outside of the country. If you live in a Chinese border region along the north of the country and someone smuggles you in a phone that's on a Chinese network, then you can call out from there. But you have to be near the border, and that's illegal. Also, if you know a little bit about electronics, you can recalibrate your radio to pick up stations that are beamed in from South Korea, like Voice of America, like Radio Free Asia, and other channels like that. But again, big penalties if you get caught. Chinese traders, when the DVD revolution came in China, and people were getting rid of their VCRs, some enterprising Chinese traders decided to go into North Korea and sell the old VCRs. And who's the only producer of Korean language television on the planet? It's South Korea. So they'd bring in South Korean videos of soapies and music videos and things like that. So a lot of people are aware of what's going on in South Korea. But again, if you're in survival mode, you've got bigger problems than figuring what to do about a South Korean soap opera and how that impacts on your life. So there's an order of priorities that exists.
If there are no more questions, I will call on Martin to say a few thank yous.